Lecture 10, Language Families, Diversity of Structures.
One of the most important aspects of this series will be to show that language varies a lot more than we might think. We all grow up speaking a certain language, and for various reasons, Westerners in particular tend to learn languages in school that are rather similar to English in grand scale. So, as a result, it might be easy to think that when we talk about language, we're talking about something more or less like English, French, and German. Now, I've given some hints already that that's not the case, but I thought that it would be worth it in this lecture to take a closer look at some families of languages that are built on a very different plan from good old Indo-European, and show that just as there are many ways of being human, there are many, many ways of having a language. Although, as we'll see in a much later lecture, there is very little correlation between the ways there are of being human and the ways there are of organizing a grammar. Nevertheless, the basic diversity is amazing and vast in both cases. I think that our first trip should be to Semitic land, the Semitic language family. Now, technically, Semitic is not a family, it's a subfamily. Indo-European is a family, and the family that Semitic belongs to is called Afro-Asiatic. And roughly speaking, Afro-Asiatic is a kind of a cap on top of Africa. And then, in the southern part of Africa, is mostly a group called Niger-Congo. But Afro-Asiatic is kind of like the snow cap on the mountaintop of Africa, so to speak, if you think of Africa as a mountain, which it's not shaped like. Let's get out of this analogy. Anyway, so, Afro-Asiatic. Afro-Asiatic includes various groups. If you ever meet anybody who speaks Hausa, that's part of the Chadic subfamily, and Hausa is one of a great many languages there. Berber people speak languages of the Berber subfamily. Then, Somali, for example, of Somalia, is one of the languages of the Cushitic subfamily. So Afro-Asiatic is huge, just like Indo-European is. One of the subfamilies of Afro-Asiatic is Semitic. And Semitic is best known for its flagship members, which are Arabic and Hebrew. Those are the two best known. So Arabic and Hebrew are very closely related. Ironically, the tensions between people who speak those languages are tensions between people who speak languages that are built on a very similar plan and have a lot of similarly shaped words, etc. In any case, Arabic and Hebrew are spoken in the Middle East, and so are many other Semitic languages, such as Aramaic. That is another Semitic language. There are records of various extinct Semitic languages in this region, such as Akkadian and Phoenician. And Semitic languages are almost unique in the world in that they have a particular feature, which is that they base their words on roots of three consonants, and then the way that you encode meaning is by altering the vowels between them and around them. And so, it's kind of like in English where we say come, and then to make it past, we say came. We call that an irregular verb, where what changed was just that vowel in the middle. There's no comed. Instead, you change the vowel. In Semitic languages, that kind of thing is normal. And so they've got their prefixes and their endings. But the vowel changing in between is quite normal, and it's more than one. It's the vowel in between the first and the second consonant, and the vowel in between the second and the third. So you take one root, like, for example, KTB, we could call it in Arabic. And so, KTB. And you can get a whole lot of bang for your buck out of KTB. So, Kataba is he wrote. So you have all A's, A's. Then, Yaktubu, Yaktubu is he writes. So you have this prefix, Ya, the K and the T jammed together. Then you have an U, then B, then an U as an ending. Then the word for book is kitab, so k-i-t-ab, like that. And here it's a noun. If you are a bookseller, you're a k-u-t-u-b-i. And again, all of these words have the k-t-b in common. And office is a maktab. And so the ma makes it into a kind of a noun. And then you have kt'ab. And then a maktub is a letter. Then a katib is a writer. And kitba is writing. And so on and so on and so on. And it's important to remember that that's not just a cute little thing that happens with KTB. That's throughout the language. And so there are hundreds and hundreds of these roots. And they take these sorts of changes. Now, this means that we have a system very different from the one that we're used to. And on top of that, the length of a vowel can mark a difference in meaning. And so for us, this is not something that we have to think about much. There's a cat, and then if there's a cat, then it's just that you talk funny. You know, there's no other object, cat, that hangs from the wall that you use to clean things up or something like that. But in Arabic, kataba is he wrote, but then kataba, where the first ah is longer, is he corresponded. And so these differences are important to meaning in these languages. So Semitic has this kind of triliteral root. It's called, to give you some fancy jargon that I forbid you to remember, non-concatenative morphology, but we're going to call it triliteral roots. And Semitic has this feature. And it's interesting that these families can spread across many different cultures and peoples. So we must not suppose that there is something about being an Israeli or an Arab that leads you to conceive of the world as denoted by triconsonantal roots. Actually, most of the Semitic languages, not just some, but most numerically, are spoken across the Red Sea in Ethiopia. And so there are languages like Amharic and lesser-known ones like Tigray and Tigrinya. And so Laila in Hebrew is night. In Amharic, that word is Leilat. And so you have other parallels like this that show that these languages are related. Now, they've been separate for a very long time. There's been a lot of change, and so they're nowhere near mutually intelligible. The speakers themselves could go a while without realizing there was any relationship between their languages. But you do see some interesting kinds of retentions in both of them based on the fact that any Semitic language is based on these triconsonantal roots. So, for example, in Hebrew, let's say you want to say, you're wearing it. So it's kind of like that. Remember that old Palmolive commercial where the woman would say, well, it depends on whether you watch TV, but where the woman would put somebody's fingers in the Palmolive and you're soaking in it. Well, imagine somebody saying, you're wearing it. And so in Hebrew, that would be the actress who would put the fingers in the Palmolive is dead now. Anyway, you're wearing it. It would be in Hebrew, ata lovesh oto. So the ata is you, lovesh is wear, oto is it. Now let's forget the you and the it, the ata and the oto. They go. So, just wear. Lo vesh. So, this is a triconsonantal root. And so, u, v, sh in Hebrew. Now in Amharic, if you want to say, why, darling, you're wearing it, then you say, tilebsa wallet. That's how you say it in Amharic. And this is a whole different thing. Amharic crams more into a word than Hebrew usually does. And so you're wearing it as all one word. But what's significant about tilebsawala compared to ata lovesh oto in Hebrew is this little lebs. Because, first of all, you have the ul. Then you don't have a V like in Hebrew. You have a B. But if you think about it, B and V have a kind of a relationship. If you're familiar with Spanish, you know how there's a certain synergy between those two sounds, substituting for each other according to dialect. And if you make a B, then you make a V, you see that both of them involve the lips. Very often in language change, a B becomes a V. So B is at one end of the alphabet and V is at the other. But if you're a good junior linguist, you realize that actually B and V have a relationship. They date, basically. So, ul, those match, and then v and b are essentially variations on a pattern, and perhaps more intuitive is that sh and s, which you have in Amharic, are related. And so s can become sh can become s. So, you have a lul sh root in Hebrew, and then a lbs in Amharic. That's because these are related languages. And so where in both of them, in a way, is unpronounceable. What it is something like lbs, but it's in both of them. So That is what makes a Semitic language. This system with the three consonants is very rare in the world. There are only a few other languages in the world that act like this, and they are, oddly enough, just a few, depending on how you count few, you could say one and a half, Native American languages of California. And there's no relationship. If there's perhaps some story about wandering Jews who wound up as hunter-gatherer Indians in California, I'm not aware of it, but I think there's no relationship. And so this kind of grammar only arose anywhere else on earth once. So that is Semitic. That's the Semitic subfamily of Afroasiatic. And it's always nice to take a walk over to Semitic to see how a language can work. And now we're going to go to a very different place. We're going to walk from Semitic. We're going to go down remnants of the Silk Road, and we're going to cross China, and we're going to be asked a lot of questions, and we're going to keep going because we're looking for East and Southeast Asia. And here, languages become quite different again from Semitic or Indo-European or anything that we might imagine a language might be. One useful thing for someone who is interested in languages and how they work, who is afraid of tones, is to learn some Japanese. Just get a sense of what Japanese is like to see how different language can be. Because Japanese is not that hard for an English speaker to learn once you get used to some really peculiar things. And Japanese people tend to be very nice to people who are butchering their language. Cultures differ on this. They're people who won't let you open your mouth. I mean, I've been in Holland, and I tried to speak Dutch, and I was almost assaulted. They don't want to hear it, anything but perfect, and they all speak English better than you. Whereas with Japanese, they love it if you make even the slightest little eruption in their language, and they think it's just wonderful to hear you doing it. There's a little bit of, oh, look at the talking monkey, but that sort of thing can be fun for short, week-long periods. So, Japanese is fun because it's built in a way that almost makes you wonder whether these people are the same species as you, just in terms of the way they put language together. But clearly, they are. And so it's really just that there's a lot of diversity, and what we're used to is just one way of doing it. So, if we go to East and Southeast Asia, there is no such thing as the Asian family of languages. We're actually dealing with very different groups. There's a group that includes Chinese languages and Tibetan, and that's called Sino-Tibetan. And then there is a group called Austroasiatic, which includes Vietnamese and Cambodian, also known as Khmer. And then there is the Thai Kadai group that has Thai in it and Laotian. And then scattered among those languages is a group that's cutely called Miao Yao, and it includes Hmong. And so those are four completely different groups. There's no Asian family. But those groups, for reasons we'll see in another lecture, tend to have certain similarities. And these similarities are in ways that are very different from how we often think of language as working. So, for example, these languages are very telegraphic compared to what we think of as being necessary to say. And what I mean by that is that there's an awful lot that they just leave to context. Things that you would think you would have to mark while you're communicating, they just leave out, and you gradually realize, well, I guess I didn't really need to know that. So they tend to really strip it down. So you might think that certainly a normal language has separate words for he and she. You would think, because there seems to be a rather salient difference between men and women that would occasion remark, at least sometimes. But actually, in these languages, that is very rarely the case. He and she and it are all the same word. There are no words for a and the, whether something has been brought up before, whether you're introducing it into the conversation, that is the cat that we are talking about, or a cat that came up and bit me. These differences are not ones that all grammars try to mark in any way. You might think that there has to be a difference between I and my, but not necessarily. If I say I book and within the right context, you know that I'm talking about my book. That's the way these languages tend to work. And so, as a result, just an ordinary sentence of a language like Cantonese Chinese can be quite different from what we would expect. So, for example, if you want to say, he's my classmate, in Cantonese. Then word for word, the way it translates is the first word is ke, and that means he, she, or it. So ke does not shave, ke does not wear a girdle, it has no gender. Then there is no is. There's no, you don't have to say that she is my classmate. Because if you think about it, what is, you know, as a president once explored? Do you really need to say that? You know, I dance at night. I question authority. I am your father. What are you amming? What are you being? Why was that even necessary to say, if you think about it? Really, why isn't it just I, your father? The association between the two is quite clear because you said one after you said the other. So, you know, no to be. And it's very common in a language to not have that. So, he, she, it, then no to be. We're talking about my classmate. Then my is ngo. But my, this ngo, is also the word for I. So we don't have to have a separate word indicating that it's a matter of possession. Possession is so common that usually it can be left to context. And then, tunhok is the word for classmate. So what you kind of have is something roughly along the lines of, instead of he's my classmate, it, I, classmate. And then, on top of that, you stick a little bit of stuff at the end of it. In this case, it would be the word lega. And what this, it doesn't translate at all. It really just gives a hint of what we would connote when we said, you know. And that's because this is a language where these sorts of things that we consider assumed when we're communicating are often marked. So you're not really just saying, he is my classmate. Beep. It's connected to the world. Somebody probably asked you, who is he? Or you see this person walking across the parking lot on their way to Target, and you want to point the person out, oh, that's my classmate, which is a different sort of a thing. You're saying that for some reason. You don't wake up out of a sound sleep, rub your eyes, and say, he's my classmate. It has some sort of context. Well, it's this lega that gives the context. So that's the way it works. Or if you want to say something like, it's better to write with a red pen. In Cantonese, the way that pans out is, use red pen, write good a bit. And they're not playing. That's really the way you say it. So use red pen, write good a bit. Also gives you a sense of what it would be like to try to learn Chinese. I remember once my father, who was given to charming exaggeration, said, it takes 25 years to learn how to speak Mandarin Chinese. And he would often just make things up. I don't know where he got that. It doesn't take 25 years, but the insight was correct that it takes you longer to become competent in a language that's different from your own than a language that is closer. So, because all of these things are left out, it's easy to think, well, golly, you know, these people just don't have any darn grammar. You know, how come they don't say these things? Boy, it leaves a lot to context. It makes things look very exotic. But actually, a language can hide complexity in ways that we're not prepared to look for. It's so easy to process things as junk, which are actually significant. I remember at one point I had a roommate in college, and he had, there was this female person, and the two of them were always kind of giggling together. There was always just some kind of big joke. Now, technically, he had a girlfriend, and technically, she had a boyfriend. But whenever my roommate was with her, there was all this giggling and all these in-jokes. And there was clearly something in the air. Something was very funny. And I always just thought, boy, they have a peculiar relationship. They're always kind of laughing. There's always this kind of arched eyebrow. I wasn't prepared for what real life was like because I was still in my late teens. I was still very tender. It turned out years later that they actually had been, shall we say, dating surreptitiously. Now, I thought of all that laughing and giggling as just junk. I thought, well, some people must laugh more than others. But actually, they were laughing at the evil that they were committing and the joy in its commission. Nowadays, that I'm aging and more bitter, I look at things like that that don't quite make sense, that stick out, the car that's not parked right. And you think to yourself, that means something. So now if two people are doing too much giggling, I know what's going on. In the same way, with Cantonese, there are things where you think, well, that's just the junk. And in this case, it's things that are hanging at the end. But actually, there's much more significance behind them than you might think. And so, for example, if you say, oh, this machine's very reliable, in response to someone saying, boy, that machine is a piece of junk, you say, this machine's very reliable, then you don't just say, this machine is very reliable. You have to say, this machine is very reliable. Then you have to have this little particle to indicate that you are objecting to something someone already said. Now, we do it with a little bit of melody. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We wouldn't think about it. Nobody would teach it. We wouldn't teach it to anyone else. We don't think about it. But in Cantonese, besides intonation, you have to say, this machine's very reliable, git. And that git has to be on there. If you don't say that, then you're a person who doesn't seem to quite complete their sentences. It's machine's very reliable, git. And that's very important. You have to have a marker for that. And there are lots of these markers conveying all sorts of things that we would never think of as even being part of a language. And so, for example, if you are you're 8 and your parents send you to bed, and you're laying there and you're laying there, and then you don't go to sleep, and so you get up in your little footsie pajamas and you walk back out into the living room, and your parents say, what are you doing up? And you say, it's too noisy. Now, once again, it's not that you're saying, hello, mother and father, it is too noisy. You're contextually bound here. There's a reason you said it's too noisy. And in this case, you didn't say it's too noisy because in 1917, something happened in North Dakota that made an old woman very sad. That's not why you said it. You said it's too noisy because there was noise out there, and that's why you can't sleep. So that's why you're saying it. You're implying that it's too noisy, and that has relevance to something that's going on. It's not about 1917. It's about tonight. Well, we would just say, it's too noisy. And the way we said it implies that. Nobody would say, what's the relevance of that statement that you made? We know. Cantonese has to dot that I and cross that T. So to indicate that the reason that you're saying it's too noisy is because it's too noisy, then you have to say la. And so you'd say, it's too noisy, la. And that's right there. The la is not something along the lines of hey or yo or shucks. It really does specifically mean that this is the relevance to the situation that I'm trying to imply. So you have these particles, and then on top of that, the particles can be strung together to indicate exactly how you're feeling about a situation as you say something and how what you said is connected with it. And so, for example, there could be a sentence where what you're trying to say is what we would say in English as, all I want is for Vincent to be good to me. And you've had a long conversation, blah, 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 blah. It's a sitcom, imagine. And in minute 21, finally, the music comes up on the soundtrack, and you say, all I want is for Vincent to be good to me. Well, the way that you would render that in Cantonese is, now, little digression here. Some of you may have noticed that I've been very careful in this lecture about trying to actually utter as little Cantonese as possible. And the reason for that is that it's something that I've always been very ashamed of, but I'm going to admit it here. I don't speak Cantonese. And more to the point, you can fake a lot of languages if you're a linguist, except when it comes to the tones. Frankly, I'm afraid of the tones, and the reason I'm afraid of the tones is because they are very difficult for the non-native to render properly. And in my experiences with Chinese people where I have tried to speak their language, it's clear that the tones take a great deal of work. You say a sentence back to them thinking you've imitated them perfectly, and it's obvious that you've said something about standing on your head or something about their mother, and they laugh uproariously again and again and ask you to say it again and laugh harder, and they point. So this is a silly way of saying that one cannot fake these tones, and I have no training in Cantonese, and I don't want to offend the Cantonese-speaking ear, even abstractly, by rattling off these words and sentences in a way that would sound absolutely ridiculous and inauthentic to the Cantonese speaker. So I am going to read one Cantonese sentence, and I am not going to render the tones because it would take years of training for me to do so. But what's in the sentence is so important that I want to get this in. So with apology to all people who grew up with this fascinating language, the way that you say at the end of the sitcom, "All I want is for Vincent to be good to me," is something like, "Go you Vincent de go ho tel dakila," something like that. Now, the point is that "I want Vincent to me be good" is just one part. So, "Ngo yu Vincent de ngo ho," right there. Then after that, you have "tao da ge la," and it's these little bits of stuff. Each one of those bits of stuff conveys something that's very important. The "tao" conveys kind of then, like here we are at the end and there's the music on the soundtrack. "Dak" conveys that this sums up everything that we've talked about. Then there's the "ge," which asserts. And so this machine's very reliable. The idea being, no, I don't want the sun, I don't want the moon, I don't want the stars. All I want is for Vincent to be good to me. So that's the "ge." Then there's the "la." The idea being that the reason that we're talking about this, the reason we're going through all this is, well, what I want is for Vincent to be good to me. So, "tao da ge la." Now, we might look at all that as giggling. Like, oh, they have all these assertive particles at the ends of their sentences because they're more expressive people than us. And obviously, that's ridiculous. This is grammar. That is part of speaking Cantonese. That sort of thing is very common in languages of this region. So that is called, those particles mark something that linguists call pragmatics. If you'd like to remember that, you can. But generally, just look at how interesting they are. In any case, Cantonese has about 30 of those particles. Finally, in languages of this part of the world, there's something which is called numeral classifiers. And the way these work is that whenever you use a noun with a number, you have to add a little word that classifies what kind of noun it is for no particular reason other than that you just do. English has a little bit of this with something like two head of cattle. You can say two cows, two bulls. I guess you can't say two cattles. You have to say two head of cattle. It's kind of redundant. None of us assume that cattle had handles. Two head of cattle. But you do. But imagine if you had to do that for just any object instead of it being this archaic and peculiar construction that comes from the farm. So, for example, in Cantonese, there's the word tsung, which is used when you're talking about things that are flat. And so if yacht means one and toy means table, then to say one table, you don't just say yacht toy. Again, sorry Cantonese speakers for the bad or lack of tones. You have to say yacht zheng toy. So it's kind of like one flat of table, something like that. Then you do it with paper. And so ji is paper. So yacht zheng ji, not just yacht ji, that's baby Cantonese. Yacht zheng ji, and you have to know. Then if something is round, then the numeral classifier is different. It's tsik. And so, ya tsik gaidan, one egg, like one blob of egg. And then if it's a wristwatch, then that's also round, and so it's one blob of wristwatch. And so, ya tsik taobu. And then, if you have something that is long and thin, like, for example, a pen, a bat, then you have tsi. And so, ya tsi bat. And if it's a flute, deck, then it's ya tsi deck. And so on and so on. Now, what's important is that you have dozens of these particles in Cantonese. And it gets to the point where it's not always so predictable what class something is going to be in, but you have to use them. And therefore, what this is a different way of having gender. Because these things are putting all of these nouns into these kinds of categories that we, with genderless, naked English, would never think of as being necessary. And yet that is part of speaking these languages. That is very common in Southeast Asia. Those are called numeral classifiers. And they are part of what make learning these languages difficult. Japanese has these as well. So, the point here has been to show that language gets really, really different. Talk about diversity of peoples and talk about diversity of cultures. Languages can be laid out on plans quite different than what Indo-European has us used to. This is the sort of thing that the language change process this series is about has produced.